Barker, Barnhart, Berger, Beyer, Bonamici, Boone, Boquist, Bruin, Buckley, Burley, Butler, Cameron, Cannon, Clem, Cowan, Dallum, Dingfelder, Chris Edwards, David Edwards, Esquivel, Flores, Galizio, Gerard, Gelzer, Gilliam, Gilman, Gerard, Greenlick, Hannah, Holby, Hunt, Jensen, Comp, Kotek, Krieger, Crummel, Lim, McPherson, Maurer, Minnis, Morgan, Nathanson, Nelson, Nolan, Olson, Reed, Richardson, Riley, Roblin, Rosenbaum, Schaffler, Scott, Shields, Greg Smith, Patty Smith, Thatcher, Tomei, Wisnet, Witt, Mr. Speaker, Excused, Cameron, Cowan, Greenlick, Scott, Thatcher.
flag salute will be led by Representative Chip Shields.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
The opening ceremony this morning will be presented by Don Behem, Humanist Minister of Beaverton and a guest of Representative Carolyn Tomei.
Good morning. Thank you for allowing me to address you again in this beautiful symbol of democracy and freedom. I've titled my words to you today, The Ultimate Communication. If you knew me yesterday, please do not think that I am the same person in your presence today. According to Webster's, the word communication is defined as a giving or giving and receiving of information by talk, gestures, writing, etc., a process by which information is made common, that is, it is shared. However, Webster's notwithstanding, you have another more powerful way of communicating with me if you choose. You can communicate to me who you are, just as I can communicate to you who I am, by each of us letting the other see and experience our real self, telling the other who we are, the ultimate communication. In our society today, we have placed great emphasis on being real or authentic. Yet many of us oftentimes paradoxically try to mask our real self by playing certain roles in an attempt at disguise. This role-playing then implies that because of our reluctance to disclose our real self, somewhere inside of each of us lurks our real self, longing for expression, longing to communicate. Despite this reluctance, there are moments when we allow our own real self to shine out of us. There are other moments, however, when we feel compelled to camouflage our real self because something about the other person or the situation does not feel safe. I believe that on rare occasion there is some justification for this reluctance. But I think that many of us hide our real self unnecessarily, depriving us of the possibility of the highest communication possible, intimacy, the greatest experience in human existence. Apparently, some of us believe that our own real self is a static and fully formed reality inside of each of us. Even if we wanted it to be, it is not. There is no fixed and true and real self inside of you or inside of me, precisely because our real self is our own unique individual personhood, being a person. And one's own unique individual personhood necessarily implies becoming a person, being in process. If I am anything as a person, it is what I feel, think, judge, value, honor, esteem, love, hate, desire, hope for, believe in, and am committed to. These are the qualities that define a person's real self, and they ought to be constantly in process, in the process of change. Unless one's heart and mind have become hopelessly barricaded, many of these things and more that make up one's real self will be changing. My own real self is not a little hardcore inside of me, a little fully formed reality that is permanent and fixed. My own real self does indeed imply an ongoing dynamic process. So again, if you knew me yesterday, please do not think that I am the same person that you are experiencing today. I have experienced more of life. I've encountered new depths in those I love. I have had new joys and sorrows and other moving experiences. So please, do not give me a score or assessment on how real or authentic you see me right now based on how you saw me yesterday, because I'm still becoming, learning and growing constantly and welcoming the challenges and opportunities of daily living in the best way I know. And if you think that I am at any moment hiding unnecessarily, please tell me, gently, approached me then with a sense of wonder, studying my face and my hands and my voice and my essence for the signs of change, for it is certain that I have changed. But even if you see that I am different, and I sense that you do, I may still be somewhat afraid to tell you who I am. You see, I'm not quite done yet. I'm still becoming. And as you love and accept me more and more, I become less and less afraid and more likely to tell you who I am. I thank you for that. Are any of you afraid to tell someone who you are? Are any of you, my friends, afraid of the ultimate communication? I sometimes am. Thank you and good day.
Colleagues, I'm saddened to report, as many of you may know, that our former colleague Matt Sumner passed away last night, and I'd like to invite Representative Bruce Hanna to come up.
Good morning, colleagues. It is with a heavy heart that this news is brought to you. Many of you knew Mac and worked with him. You knew what a friend he was, and that eventually we're going to get to the point where we're celebrating his life and the sorrowful pain will go away. I just got to tell you a quick story about Mac, because a good way to remember a friend is always fun. In this very last session, Mac Sumner stood next to me on the steps out here, and I had had surgery about 2 days prior to that, but being a little vain, I didn't want to miss the picture, right? So I showed up here on the steps, and I'm standing there kind of wobbling around, and Mac's standing next to me, and I really don't know the guy, and he puts his hand underneath my coat jacket and against my back, and he says, "Boy, you're really sweaty. You don't feel good, do you?" I said, "No, not very good." And he said, "Well, just lean on my hand. I got your back." And I thought to myself, here's a guy that I don't know at all who just said, "I got your back." And he meant it literally and figuratively. And I'll not forget that gesture. Would you please bow with me in prayer? Our Heavenly Father, we're so grateful to have known Mac Sumner. We're especially grateful, Lord, that you've received him into your kingdom and that his pain is no longer. Lord, we just ask that you would comfort and bless Sandy, Mac's wonderful wife, his extended family. Lord, that you'd bring them through this time of sorrow to a time of rejoicing, that they know Mac is home with you. Lord, we'd ask each one who hears of Mac's passing to reach out to you and ask blessing for that family. And Lord, we'd ask that each one might also, in their own way, be the hand in the back of that family that, if so possible, could bless them in any way. We're thankful we have the opportunity to greet you and come to you, and we ask all this in Jesus' name. Amen.
Thank you, Bruce, for leading us in those thoughts. Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Colleagues, please join me in welcoming Dr. Don Bayham. Dr. Bayham is a psychologist here in the Portland area, or up in the Portland area, and has his own cable television show called Dr. Don. Don is a humanist minister with the American Humanist Association and the Humanists of Greater Portland. He is originally from New Orleans. He tried to help me pronounce it correctly. And something of which he is most proud is that he is the father of five beautiful daughters, has numerous grandchildren, and not only that, his family says that he is a great grandfather. Please help me extend courtesies to Dr. Don Baham. Thank you so much.
Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, colleagues. Please join me in welcoming some special guests that are here today in the rear gallery. They are representatives of the Portland Rose Festival and are here to enjoy our celebration of the Rose Festival in SJR 26, which we will be taking up this morning. So please join me in welcoming them to the Capitol.
Good to have you here. Representative Cannon.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Colleagues, I'd like you to join me in welcoming a couple of honorary pages. First, if Jonah Badden could please stand up. Jonah is the son of Les and Jerry Badden from Portland, attends Mount Tabor Middle School, where he's a seventh grader. Jonah's in the school band and is on the lacrosse team. He's on the school honor roll and loves playing the guitar. His career goals include being an environmentalist. I certainly appreciate that. Thank you, Jonah. And the other honorary page from also from Mount Tabor Middle School is Thomas Brim Edwards, also a seventh grader. On the school honor roll, likes to play baseball, basketball, and football, wants to be a professional baseball player. Thank you both for being here, and enjoy your day in the Capitol.
Representative Roblin.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. It's my honor to introduce a couple of the honorary pages for Representative Cowan, who had to be in her district this morning. So first, Dylan McCarthy, if you want to stand up, Dylan. Dylan's parents, Penelope and Dan McCarthy, from Newport, seventh grader at Isaac Newton Magnet School. Dylan is in the school band, plays the trumpet, takes part in the Saturday Academy classes, robots, engineering, and others. And he's interested in nanotechnology, computer science and computer programming, law and real estate. He has a lot of things ahead of him. So welcome this morning, and I hope all of you extend the courtesies of the House to this young man as he's here today. Also, we have Elliot Leslie. Jeannie and Kent Leslie are his parents from Newport, also at Isaac Newton Magnet School. Elliot belongs to the Winter Guard, plays the saxophone in the school band, plays basketball, enjoys filmmaking, engineering, and Legos, which is kind of a fun one. I have always enjoyed Legos myself, so I'm excited about that. Elliot wants to be involved in engineering, exploration, and archaeology. Again, my gratitude for him being here and for the opportunity to introduce these two for Representative Cowan. Thank you.
Representative Bill Garrard.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I, too, would like to welcome an honorary page from Klamath Falls, Kelsey Pellegrino, who is a senior at KUHS and is into tennis, cross country, orchestra, math, team, and key club. She is also in the National Honor Society, Tri-Am Music Honor Society. She'll be majoring in business administration at the University of Portland to be a CPA, and we welcome Kelsey.
Representative Gilliam.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I want to introduce a couple of honorary pages, but before I do, I wanted to thank the representative from District 7 for his words. About our friend Max Sumner. I'm sorry, Mr. Speaker.
Mr. Speaker, if I may.
I ask for unanimous consent to suspend the rules to allow Representative Buckley to use Representative Gilliam's microphone. Is there an objection? Hearing none, please go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, colleagues, we're honored to have two honorary pages from Representative Gilliam's district, Rebecca Kaufman. If you'd stand, Rebecca. Rebecca's hometown is from Silverton. She attends Central Howell School. Rebecca is into physical education and baseball. She enjoys going to the beach and family gatherings, and she wants to be a nurse. Good to have you here, Rebecca. And also, we have Lorraine Stavelli, also from Silverton. Sadly, hard to read on the page. My apologies, but great to have you here. Also a seventh grader from Central Howell. Lorraine is into physical education and swimming. She loves family vacations and family gatherings. She wants to be a cake decorator, interior decorator, or chef. Welcome.
Are there further courtesies? Representative George Gilman has a birthday today. It's a happy birthday. Further courtesies. Messages from the governor. Messages from the Senate.
Mr. Speaker, I'm directed by the President of the Senate to pass Senate Bill 58-104-473-1034, House Bill 2188-2702, adopted HCR 4, 5, and 10. Mr. Speaker, I'm directed by the President to inform you that he has signed Senate Bill 451.
First reading, memorials and resolutions. Standing committee reports. The committee report file has been distributed. Special committee reports. Special orders of business. Representative Hannah, for what purpose do you rise?
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I'd request a 15-minute recess for the purpose of a Republican caucus.
Representative Hannah asks for a 15-minute recess for the purpose of the Republican caucus. Representative Hunt, do you wish to have anything? Very good. Is there an objection? Seeing none, we'll stand in recess for 15 minutes. Call the roll.
Barker.
Barker Barnhart.
Berger.
Beyer. Beyer Bonamici. Boone. Boquist. Boquist Bruin. Bruin Buckley. Burley. Burley Butler. Butler Cameron. Cannon. Clem. Cowan. Dallum. Dallum Dingfelder. Chris Edwards. David Edwards. Esquivel. Esquivel Flores. Flores Galizio, Gerard, Gerard Gelzer, Gilliam, Gilman, Gerard, Gerard Greenlick, Hannah, Holvey, Hunt, Jensen, Jensen Comp, Comp Kotek, Krieger, Krieger Crummel, Crummel Lim, McPherson, Maurer, Minnis, Morgan, Nathanson, Nelson, Nelson Nolan, Olson, Reed, Richardson, Riley, Roblin, Roblin Rosenbaum, Schaffler, Scott, Shields, Greg Smith, Patty Smith, Patty Smith Thatcher, Tomei, Tomei Wisnet, Witt, Mr. Speaker, not answering, Barker, Beyer, Boquist, Bruin, Butler, Dallum, Esquivel, Flores, Gerard, Gilman, Gerard, Jensen, Comp, Krieger, Crummel, Nelson, Roblin, Patty Smith, Tomei, excused, Cameron, Cowan, Scott, excused for business of the House, Dingfelder, Chris Edwards. Colleagues, we do have a quorum. When we recess, we are under special orders of business. Clerk, will read the bill.
Senate Bill 400 relating to employment relations and public collective bargaining.
Question now arises upon third reading and final passage of Senate Bill 400C. Representative Schaffler.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Senate Bill 400C modifies the definition of employment relations under public employee collective bargaining law to include safety issues that have an impact on the on-the-job safety of the employees or staffing levels that have a significant impact on the on-the-job safety of the employees. Public employee collective bargaining in Oregon has evolved over the past several decades. The Public Employee Collective Bargaining Act establishes the means for government employees to bargain with public employers. Under the Act, safety issues were once considered under other employment issues as possible mandatory bargaining issues, depending on a balancing test determining whether parties are required to negotiate on a particular subject mandatory or the subject can be negotiated if parties agree to do so permissive. Senate Bill 750 in 1995 brought major changes to public collective bargaining law, including the use of the balancing test. Under the test provisions, a proposal is not considered mandatory, it is not required to be bargained, and is only considered an arbiter by an arbiter if both parties agree for it to be bargained. Currently, safety and staffing issues can only be bargained on if they have a, quote, direct and substantial effect on the on-the-job safety of employees, unquote. Senate Bill 400C requires safety and staffing issues to become a bargaining issue only if they relate to employees' on-the-job safety or staffing levels that have a significant impact on the on-the-job safety of employees. The measure amends the definition of employment relations under Public Employee Collective Bargaining Act to include personnel who are currently prohibited by statute from striking, such as firefighters, police officers, and guards at correctional institutions and mental health hospitals. The specific change that we are here discussing today is it's on page 2 on line 27 of the bill. For employee bargaining involving employees covered by ORS 243.736, employment relations include safety issues that have an impact on the on-the-job safety of the employees or staffing levels that had a significant impact on the on-the-job safety of the employees. I just want to read this into the record. I want to make it clear that this language will still apply the reasonable person standard as it relates to a discussion of safety and staffing levels. For example, a staffing level such as reducing the number of personnel on a fire engine, say from 4 to 3 or 3 to 2, would be considered a significant impact on the on-the-job safety of employees. Another example could be a police officer patrolling late at night with no backup within a reasonable response time would also meet the intent of significant impact and require discussion, but not necessarily an agreement as it relates to staffing levels. In addition, deviation from industry and national standards as it relates to staffing would meet the threshold for a discussion on staffing levels that may indeed have a significant impact on the on-the-job safety of employees. As a legislative body, I want to make sure that our intent is to give the benefit of the doubt towards being more inclusive in discussing staffing levels rather than being prohibitive. The reason for this is that employers are not forced to agree with any personal proposal brought forth by employee representatives, and indeed can always say no. However, having a discussion on safety and staffing levels meets the spirit of collective bargaining and provides for a process that is indeed in the interest and welfare of the public. It is important that the citizens of Oregon, as well as our firefighters, police officers, and other public safety officers who risk their lives every day, understand that we as a legislative body support them. I can see no better way to support the men and women who protect us every day than by providing them the opportunity to discuss safety and staffing levels during bargaining. That has and always will be the intent of Senate Bill 400, and any ambiguity towards the word significant should afford a broader discussion rather than a narrow and constricting interpretation of significant as it relates to mandatory subjects of bargaining. Folks, as I just said, these men and women are out there working every day protecting us, and there's been a lot of discussion about funding some budgets that are relating to public safety here in the state of Oregon. This goes right directly to us supporting those men and women out there in the field who protect us every day. It's a good bill. I urge your vote. Thank you.
Further discussion, Representative Galizio.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the bill.
To the bill.
I support Senate Bill 400 for three primary reasons. First, I think as representatives of the people of Oregon, it's our duty to enhance public safety. Second, I think this process that's laid out in Senate Bill 400, is an effective process. And third, I think it utilizes the firsthand experience of our public safety officers to inform negotiations. So first, as representatives of the people of Oregon, it's our sworn duty to facilitate public safety, and I truly believe that Senate Bill 400, as newly constituted, will indeed enhance public safety in Oregon. Secondly, I think the process that's part of Senate Bill 400 provides the opportunity to bargain on the critical issue of public safety, and it's not a guarantee. It just provides that opportunity. There's no guarantee in terms of which side will prevail. So I think it's a fairness issue. Third, and perhaps most important, I think as Oregon's first responders, with their experience in the field, are in a position to know better than anybody else what they need to do their job. Just as our soldiers in Iraq and Afghanistan know what equipment they require for their safety, our men and women in uniform here in Oregon are similarly situated to know what's best and what they need to perform their job. You know, the majority of us and the majority of Oregonians on their way to work this morning may have contemplated challenging tasks, finishing a project or meeting a monthly quota or upgrading a skill. But few of us had to confront the reality that they might be severely injured or killed simply by performing the duties expected of them every single day. So Senate Bill 400 meets our duty to uphold public safety. It provides the opportunity to bargain on the critical issue of public safety, and it recognizes that those with the first-hand experience are in the best position to bring those issues to the bargaining table. I urge your aye vote.
Further discussion, Representative Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the bill.
To the bill.
Colleagues, this bill has had a long and contentious journey to a vote today. And all of us, I think, support our public safety professionals, but those who make leadership decisions know that this is a really important issue. I am willing to support this compromise represented in this latest version of Senate Bill 400 for a few very pragmatic reasons. The language supports the testimony that management is always willing to talk about safety issues, other than staffing, that have an impact on employee safety as long as there is priority consideration given to the general interest and welfare of the public, as well as consideration of the government's ability to pay. The language expresses, in different but essentially equivalent language to the present standard, that staffing levels are subject to mandatory bargaining only when it is shown there is a significant impact on employee on-the-job safety. And the political realities of this building are that we have several different versions of Senate Bill 400 floating around, one that passed the Senate, two versions have been on one vote short of passing the House. It's time now to bring this matter to a close with language that no one seems to like very much, but that has been crafted in the true spirit of compromise. There are members of my own caucus who are concerned we have set the bar too low in this compromise. I, for one, could not vote for this compromise if I thought that were the case. On the issue of bargaining over staffing levels, it all boils down to the difference between the current standard of direct and substantial effect and the proposed new standard of significant impact. Let's examine these differences. Webster's Dictionary defines substantial as, quote, considerable as an amount, ample. It defines significant as of consequence, important. The thesaurus lists the following synonyms for significant: consequential, substantial, meaningful, material, great, paramount, major, chief, main. My point here is that I can agree to accept the term significant impact as a replacement for direct and substantial because the term implies a standard that maintains a very high bar. In fact, a substantial bar, to use
one synonym for bargaining over staffing levels. As we have learned in this building, minor word changes often create major consequences, both intended and unintended. In this case, the message in my change from a nay to an aye on Senate Bill 400 is based on an intended consequence. That it is that we are at least maintaining the current threshold of bargaining over staffing levels, that we put this argument over words behind us and go to work providing for the safety of all of our citizens. Thank you.
Further discussion, Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the bill.
To the bill.
Colleagues, as you know, I've been a staunch defender of maintaining the current balance between labor and management in our public safety collective bargaining process. You also know that I place the highest priority on safety of our employees, and I have shared with you to understand that our public safety managers operate in an environment today that places safety first in their operations and practices. I guess the question I ask of myself, am I happy with this language? I can live with it. Time will tell, but it appears to be the language that gets us off the dead center and addresses most of my concerns. And let me share two things that I think the language does. First, the language makes it clear that only those safety issues that have an impact on employee on-the-job safety must be bargained. And if those issues go to binding arbitration, the arbitrator must first consider the general interest and welfare of the public in making a decision, and then he or she must also consider the government's ability to pay. I am hopeful that these limitations will keep safety issue discussions where they really belong, and that is in a cooperative environments of safety committees and labor management committees. Secondly, the compromise language preserves the intent of the current statutory language on bargaining over staffing levels. I want to make it very clear that my yes vote on this language should not be interpreted as lowering of the bar or over-bargaining of staffing levels. The only difference between the current statutory language and the proposed language on staffing levels is the difference between direct and substantial effect and significant impact on employee on-the-job safety. I can live with that change because I interpret the term significant impact to mean something of a monumental consequence. It also suggests a meaning of great importance, which exactly expresses my thoughts about employee safety. And having said that, I believe we have found solid balance. Thank you.
Further discussion, Representative Girard.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. As always, I will be brief. To the bill.
To the bill.
Colleagues, I initially was very close to voting for Senate Bill 400 in its initial form. I feel very strongly that people that put their life on the line for me deserve the best safety standards that we can provide. However, I also live in a district that is very short supply of police officers. And for me, we talk about small things being the things that tip the scale. The adding of the word significant is significant. And I'll be voting yes.
Further discussion? Seeing none, Representative Shelford, do you wish to close?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Speaker. I do. This is a good bill. It should pass. I urge your aye vote. But more importantly, I think this is a good example of how people do come together and compromise and work together. And for the people behind the cameras or in front of them and the scribblers out there that like to write about conflict in this state, I hope they write about this good example of people from across the aisle coming together to come to a solution. Because that's what we do here, and I'm darn proud of that, and I'm proud of all you. Good bill should pass. I urge your aye vote. Thanks.
Those opinion the bill should pass, vote aye. Those opposed.
Mr. Speaker.
Just a minute. Representative Shoffler?
Yes.
Representative Shoffler requests a call to the House. He is joined by Representative Rosenbaum, Representative Riley, Representative Olson, Representative Edwards, and Representative Buckley. Doorkeeper will bar the door. Sergeant Arms of 10, and the clerk will call the roll.
Barker. Barnhart. Berger. Beyer. Beyer-Bonamici. Boone. Boquist. Bruin, Buckley, Burley, Butler, Cameron, Cannon, Clem, Cowan, Dallum, Dingfelder, Dingfelder, Chris Edwards, David Edwards, Esquivel, Flores, Galizio, Gerard, Gilzer, Gilliam, Gilman, Gerard, Greenlick, Hannah, Holvey, Hunt, Jensen, Jensen Comp, Kotek, Krieger, Crummel, Crummel Lim, McPherson, Maurer, Minnis, Morgan, Nathanson, Nelson, Nolan, Nolan Olson, Reed, Richardson, Riley, Roblin, Rosenbaum, Schaffler, Scott, Shields, Greg Smith, Patty Smith, Thatcher, Tomei, Wisnet, Witt, Mr. Speaker, not answering, Beyer, Dingfelder, Chris Edwards, Jensen, Crummel, excuse, not subject to the call, 2, Cowan, Scott,
all members are present. Those opinion that Senate Bill 400C should pass will vote aye. Those opposed, no. And the clerk will open the voting system. Representative Dallum, how do you vote? Representative Dallum votes no. Representative Thatcher votes aye. Representative Flores votes no. Representative Greg Smith. Representative Greg Smith votes aye. Representative Burley votes no. Representative Crummel votes no. All members have voted. Senate Bill 400C, having received a constitutional majority, is declared passed. Clerk, read the next bill. The consideration of SJR 26 is set to a time specific of 10 o'clock, which we are not at, so we will, the chair asks for unanimous consent to temporarily advance the order of business to propositions and motions. Is there an objection? Hearing none, so ordered. Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Before I get started, may I just quickly ask permission to return to courtesies following this bill? Or should I ask you after the bill?
We'll return to you for that purpose after this bill.
Thank you very much. Mr. Speaker, I move the House concur in the Senate amendments to House Bill 2372 and repass the bill.
Representative Gilliam moves the House concur in the Senate amendments to House Bill 2372 and repass the bill. To your motion.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I'd like it noted for the record that I'm up here without a wire. You'll see no, or without a net, I guess the term is. You'll see no staff person here. I read explanation of this bill without fear of contradiction. Oh, help has arrived. This bill requires employers of 25 or more employees to provide unpaid rest periods to employees to express milk. If providing rest periods does not cause undue hardship to operation of employers' business, requires employers to make reasonable efforts to provide a private location where employees can express milk. Limits to mothers expressing milk for their own children. Allows employers to use single or multiple undue hardship factors to justify exemption from requirements of measure. Requires employees to give reasonable notice to employers of their intention to express milk in the workplace. It excludes the topic of expressing milk from collective bargaining for school districts. It provides civil penalty provision for intentional violations. It creates an advisory council to respond to a particular industry's request to address compliance difficulties. Senate amendments provide that sums collected as civil penalties to be paid to the Department of Human Services for the breastfeeding mother-friendly employer project after administration and hearing costs. This bill resolves the conflicts with Senate Bill 400. It passed the Senate 28-1, and I'm open for further comment.
Further discussion, Representative Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the motion.
To the motion.
Colleagues, it's been said of Oregon that we are either the first or the last among states for anything. In this case, I think we can be very proud we are the first. Not perhaps the first to consider this issue, but the first to have our employers with much discomfort and wiggling come forward and admit that this small but important segment of our working population, those breastfeeding mothers, have special needs that can and will be met in the workplace. I think we can congratulate all those employers because this is not an easy thing. But I think it shows that we as a state value our children in a very special way, value our families in a very special way, and I hope you'll all go out of this session counting this as one of those Oregon firsts that you can be most proud of. Thank you.
Further discussion to the motion, Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the motion.
To the motion.
Colleagues, I too rise in support of repassage of this bill. I think it's really a great day here in Oregon that we are actually able to pass a bill and have such strong bipartisan support to do so. This is truly a bill that is going to benefit just about everybody. It's about healthy babies. It's about healthy moms. It will benefit employers because they will have people at work who are able to do their jobs without being torn by the conflict between doing what's best for their new children and wanting to do a good job too. Every day it seems like we read about new benefits that are being attributed to breastfeeding, and you know, those include reduced rates of obesity, reduced rates of childhood illness, and so everyone will be healthier as a result of this bill. As the speaker has been known to say, I think that the word for this bill is hallelujah. And I want to especially acknowledge somebody who's in the gallery who has done really remarkable work for years to get this passed. And that is, I think, somebody who embodies the very spirit of citizen activism, Diane Garrett, who's up in the gallery with her daughter, and the Nursing Mothers Council, who have worked with her tirelessly to get this passed. So I would applaud them, too, and urge us all to support this bill.
Further discussion? Seeing none, Representative Gilliam, do you wish to close?
Yes, Mr. Speaker, I do wish to close. This bill took a lot of time, and it was one of the first bills that I began to hear in my term here. And I had some problems with the bill. This is prior to the Senate version that we're looking at. But we worked those so-called problems out, and I learned a great deal in the process. And as I said in committee once, I was bottle-fed, and that may be the strongest reason to support this bill. I just would say that for an enlightened workplace where employers and employees work together for the common good, for mothers who are working and deserve a clean and private place to express milk for their babies, and for healthy babies, I urge your support.
Those who are of the opinion that the motion should be adopted will vote aye. Those opposed, no. And the clerk will open the voting system. Representative Clem, how do you vote? Clem votes aye. Representative Gelser votes aye. Representative Dallum, how do you vote? Dallum votes aye. House Bill 2372B, the motion. House Bill 2372B, having received a constitutional majority, is declared repassed. Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Representative Gilliam requests a temporary return to the order of courtesies. Is there an objection? Hearing none, please go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. And thank you to all my colleagues on what is a difficult day. I will not go back there right now for fear of the same result, but thank you all for your support. I am particularly happy today to return to courtesies, because I want to introduce you to a friend of mine. He's an Oregon treasure. Now, you got your ducks, you got your beavers, that's all fine. But I'm here to talk about the Knights, the Warner Pacific College Knights, an institution that, for some reason, had the wisdom to grant me a degree in 1975, where I was a classmate with this gentleman. And I thought I was going to introduce him to you, but as I've been talking to him on the side aisle, I found that this visitor has two former students in the legislature. One is Senator Beyer from the other, it's
but the Senate. And another is the representative from the center of Portland. So I can't introduce this guy around. He already knows everybody. But I can brag about him a little bit and say this. My guest, Bart Valentine, is the athletic director and head coach at Warner Pacific College Basketball. And a few years ago, our college was on some hard times and had to cut athletics. That was in 1991. Fortunately, things came back, but to revive an athletic program after an eight-year hiatus is quite a feat. In 1999, Bart Valentine did just that. Bart's first coaching spot was at Malala in our district, and then at Colton. And then he went on to West Lynn, where he won the state championship and was coach of the year before going to Warner Pacific College. Now, Warner Pacific College men's basketball has made their second appearance in the NAIA National Tournament. And they finished ranking seventh nationally. This is an incredible feat for any coach, but particularly one that brought a program back from nothing. But the thing I want to emphasize when I introduce Bart this morning is this. Bart likes to win. But Bart likes seeing his men and women from his athletic programs graduate. And he invests in their character. And that's why I call Bart the John Wooden of Oregon. Will you extend courtesies to Bart Valentine this morning? Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Are there further courtesies? Propositions and motions. Ask for unanimous consent that we temporarily advance to the order of the consent calendar. Is there an objection? Hearing none, so ordered. Clerk, read the first bill in short summary.
Senate Bill 311 relating to application for action by local government adds criteria for determining when application accounted for discretionary permits and zone changes is deemed complete for purposes of time limit for action by county.
Question now arises on third reading and final passage of Senate Bill 311. Those with opinion the bill should pass, vote aye. Those opposed, no. And the clerk will open the voting system. All have voted. Senate Bill 311, having received a constitutional majority, is declared passed. We have now arrived at the time for the special order of business, SJR 26. Clerk, read the bill.
SJR 26, encouraging Oregonians to participate in events planned for Portland Roads Festival Centennial Celebration in 2007.
Question now arises on third reading and final passage of Senate Joint Resolution 26. Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Colleagues, I bring you Senate Joint Resolution 26, and I'm very delighted to do so. In June of 1907, the mayor of Portland at the time, Harry Lane, called for an annual Rose Carnival in a speech during the Lewis and Clark Exposition Fair, and that actually was the first Rose Festival. So now, in the year 2007, it has actually been 100 years since the first Rose Festival, and we are able to celebrate the centennial, and that's a landmark occasion. So just a few interesting things about the Rose Festival. I'm sure you've all been to it and enjoyed it and know its value. But clearly, part of the mission of the Rose Festival is to drive economic activity in the region and provide all of the citizens of the entire state with a common celebration. Even though it takes place in Portland, it really serves the entire state. And we see that when we see the marching bands from all over the state and so many people coming into our area because of it. It generates an estimated $80 million annually for the region's economy through all of the events that are attracting over 2 million people of all ages and social groups. And it is really something that's about the arts, education, youth, the environment, and cultural diversity. It, as you know, it's 100 years old, as I said earlier, and it will be taking place this year between May 31st and June 10th. It's the largest civic celebration in the entire state of Oregon, attracting visitors from all over the country and the world for those 11 days. It's the largest special event in the state of Oregon, encompassing more than 30 different events during its two-week period. The parade, the big event, the Rose Parade, is the second largest of all floral parades in the United States. But as you know, that's only one thing that takes place. There's the delightful Starlight Parade, the Junior Rose Festival Parade, the ships, which everybody enjoys seeing at the seawall, and then, of course, the waterfront village. So all the rides and the funnel cakes and the food that everybody enjoys eating. And then there's the Starlight Parade, which I think I mentioned, the largest illuminated evening parade in the Pacific Northwest. So as the Rose Festival is ready to launch another century of adding so much to the fabric of life, we can celebrate its 100 years here and all the great things that it has brought. Many people are here in the gallery to also join us in celebrating the passage of this resolution. And so it came to you on a unanimous vote from the House Committee on Elections, Ethics, and Rules, and I hope it will do likewise here. Thank you.
Further discussion, Representative Greg Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I need to declare a potential conflict of interest.
Please state your potential conflict for the record.
Well, Mr. Speaker, jovially, I'm pleased to share that in the early 1920s, a very, very lovely and extraordinarily lady named Gertrude Meredith James, who is my great aunt, was a princess of the Oregon Rose Festival for Grant High School.
We're going to take your comments not as a potential conflict of interest, but as a speech in, theoretically in support, but we're not sure. But thank you. Further discussion, Representative McPherson.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I want to rise in support of this resolution and the just comment about what
to
a
the
great,
resolution
to the resolution. What a great civic event the Rose Festival is for really all of Oregon. I grew up down the valley, but we always took part in or would travel to Portland to see the Rose Festival events. And then, as some of you may know, my chosen instrument for my musical endeavors is the bagpipes. And for many years, I played in the Clan McClay Bagpipe Band, which marched each year in the Rose Festival Grand Floral Parade. And I'll tell you, I don't think I had a better time doing anything, including the things that go on in this building. Thank you.
Further discussion, Representative Boone.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the resolution.
To the resolution.
Another little-known secret of my past is, yes, I am a Grant General, and no, I was never chosen a princess, but I did march in several of the parades. I attended most of them when I was a kid, and I actually grew a rose once that didn't win a prize, but I entered the contest, and I still love that parade, and I love the festival, and I used to be guaranteed a snowstorm for the Golden Rose Ski Tournament, and that's when we would go skiing in June, and instead of sun, we would get snow, but that was great too. So please join me in supporting this resolution for this great festival.
Further discussion? Seeing none, Representative Rosenbaum, would you like to close?
Just briefly, Mr. Speaker. Colleagues, as you can hear from the comments, this festival means a great deal to the entire state of Oregon. I had forgotten to mention the ambassadors or princesses, as they've been called at various times, and they obviously are a big part of the festival, too. So once again, we're delighted to be able to celebrate and to memorialize this festival and this resolution, May 31st to June 10th of this year. We hope to see you all at one or more of the wonderful events of the Rose Festival, and thank you for supporting it.
Those who are of the opinion that the resolution should be adopted will vote aye. Those opposed, no, and the clerk will open the voting system. Representative Barnhart, how do you vote? Barnhart votes aye. Senate Joint Resolution 26, having received a constitutional majority, is declared passed. Representative Lim, for what purpose do you rise?
Mr. Speaker, could we return to the order of courtesy, please?
Representative Lim asks for unanimous consent to return to the order of courtesies. Is there an objection? Hearing none, please go ahead.
The Speaker and members, I was the former member of the Royal Rosarian last 10 years, and I'd like to welcome again the Royal Rosarian and the members, and they are official goodwill ambassadors for Portland, and they are one of the group, Royal Rosarian, Portland Rose Association, City of Portland. They are the three groups organizing all the parade, so I just want to formally welcome them. And thank you very much, Mr. Speaker.
Are there further courtesies? We are under the order of propositions and motions. Representative Richardson.
Mr. Speaker, I move that House Bill 3535 be withdrawn from the Committee on Ways and Means.
Representative Richardson moves that House Bill 3535 be withdrawn from the Committee on Ways and Means. Mason, Section 491, Subparagraph 4, states that it is not in order to discuss the merits of a bill upon a motion to withdraw the bill from committee. Debate in such cases must be confined strictly to the purpose of the motion. For if this were not true, the merits of any question could be forced under discussion merely by such a motion to withdraw. To your motion.
Mr. Speaker, House Bill 3535 is the funding bill for the Oregon State Police Patrol Division, which would dedicate 1% of general funds to a dedicated fund. This is the 121st day of this session, and on our highways, we still have preventable deaths that continue. We still have unapprehended drug carriers that continue to travel our highways. We need to show the people that we do have a priority, and that the priority is to assure we have 24/7 coverage, that we fund public safety first. Therefore, it's important that this bill come forward at this time to be deliberated with on the floor. Thank you.
Further discussion, Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Colleagues.
Speaking to the motion.
I do speak to the motion.
To the motion.
Thank you. Well, colleagues, we have possibly 7 weeks left in this building to do something with the Oregon State Police, and we've not done so with it yet. I can share numerous stories of what's happened on state highways across Oregon right now. But if you recall, a little over a week ago, I shared a story. But bottom line, I just want to share one thing, one fact that's really big. We've now had 138 deaths on the state highways, or over the roads on the state highways in the state. That's a 6% increase. Now, from my experience having been with state police, there are a number of instances, in fact, that if presence by the state police had been out there, a lot of this could have been prevented. Thank you.
Further discussion?
Representative Richardson, do you wish to close?
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Only to just remind all of us that this bill has wide support. It's supported by Oregon State Police Officers Association, Chamber of Commerce, and Federation of Independent Businesses. We need to bring this bill forward at this time, and therefore I would appreciate an aye vote on this motion to bring House Bill 3535 from committee to the floor. And we'd also request that we all have a good day.
Those are the opinion that House Bill of the motion to withdraw, support the motion to withdraw the measure from committee of Ways and Means will vote aye. Those opposed, no. And clerk will open the voting system. Representative Patty Smith, how do you vote? Representative Patty Smith? Representative Patty Smith is off the floor. Representative John Dallum votes aye. The motion, which requires 31 votes, having failed to require to have the required majority, is declared failed. Chair requests unanimous consent to temporarily advance the order of business to third reading of House bills. Is there an objection? Hearing none, so ordered. Clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 2822 relating to contested case proceedings.
Question now arises upon reading and third reading and final passage of House Bill 2822A. Representative Richardson.
Mr. Speaker, colleagues, I urge your support for House Bill 2822, which comes to you with a 7-0 support from the House Judiciary Committee. This bill was proposed by the Oregon Law Center to provide greater clarity around administrative hearings conducted by administrative law judges at the Office of Administrative Hearings. It's a good bill, and it should pass, and I urge and I vote.
Further discussion? Seeing none, Representative Richardson, do you wish to close? He does not. Those opinion the bills will pass, will vote aye. Those opposed, no. And the clerk will open the voting system.
Representative Buckley, how do you vote? Votes aye. Representative Tomei, how do you vote? Votes aye. Representative Berger, how do you vote? Votes aye. Representative Morgan, how do you vote? Votes aye. Representative Lim, how do you vote? Votes aye. House Bill 2822A, having received the constitutional majority, is declared passed. Clerk will read the next bill.
House Bill 2833 relating to Public Safety Memorial Fund.
The question now arises upon third reading and final passage of House Bill 2833A. Representative Barker.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. In the Shakespeare's play Antony and Cleopatra, at one point Cleopatra says, "The dead are well." What she's talking about is they've moved to the other side. They have no earthly worries. But those left behind may not be so well. We had this same bill last session, and I worked closely with then-Speaker Minnis to bring it forward, but it was one of the many bills that was left lying on the table when we reached sine die. Colleagues, House Bill 2833 comes to you from the Judiciary Committee, where it passed out unanimously. This bill allows a public safety officer to designate a beneficiary to receive benefits from the Public Safety Memorial Fund. Currently, a spouse, child, or dependent of an officer is eligible to receive benefits from the fund if the officer suffers a serious injury that finishes career or dies in the line of duty. The bill also expands the definition of a child for the purposes of receiving benefits to include a person 18 to 22 years old and enrolled as a full-time undergraduate student, or 18 years old or older and unable to support themselves due to a physical or mental disability. This has no fiscal impact. It's a good bill and deserves your aye vote.
Further discussion? Representative Barker, do you wish to close? He does not. Those who are of the opinion that the bill should pass will vote aye, and those opposed, no. The clerk will open the voting system. Representative Greg Smith, how do you vote? Votes aye. Representative Maurer, how do you vote? Representative Maurer, how do you vote? Votes aye. House Bill 2833A, having received the constitutional majority, is declared passed. Clerk will read the next bill.
House Bill 2864, relating to final disposition of human remains.
The question now arises upon third reading and final passage of House Bill 2864A. Representative Gilman.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. House Bill 2864A revises ORS 97, which governs the operation of cemeteries and the disposition of human remains and anatomical gifts. The bill was developed by a work group that includes the Oregon Cemetery Association, the Department of Consumer and Business Services, DCBS Finance and Corporate Securities Division regulates the endowment of care cemeteries and how they handle trust funds, as well as persons selling contracts or managing money paid by people who are preparing for their own funerals. House Bill 2864A revises provision of ORS 97 to provide greater protection to consumers, clarifies the duties of providers and master trustees, and grants the DCBS director rulemaking authority to protect the consumer and administer of the program. House Committee on Government Accountability and Information Technology unanimously approved House Bill 2864A after amending the bill to address conversion of trust funds to insurance policies and the distribution of trust funds after pre-need contracts are canceled, and to clarify the definition of master trustee. There's no known opposition to the bill. I urge your support of 2864A.
Further discussion? Representative Gilman, do you wish to close?
No, thank you.
He does not. Those who are of the opinion that the bill should pass will vote aye, and those opposed, no. The clerk will open the voting system. All members have voted. House Bill 2864A, having received the constitutional majority, is declared passed. Clerk will read the next bill.
House Bill 2876, relating to energy projects.
The question now arises upon third reading and final passage of House Bill 2876A. Representative Witt.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. Colleagues, the 74th Oregon Legislative Assembly may well go down in history as the energy session, the point when our state began in earnest efforts to free ourselves from imported fuels and to substantially reduce our carbon footprint. One of the most significant and readily attainable means to energy independence is conservation. House Bill 2876A, which comes unanimously from your Committee on Energy and Environment, is a milestone on our path to energy savings and energy freedom. The bill has two main directives. First, it requires that state agencies reduce the energy used in their buildings by at least 20% by June 30th, 2015, from a calendar year 2000 baseline. To ensure that this goal is met, the bill further requires that by January 2009, state agencies must have plans in place that specify interim steps and timelines for meeting the 20% reduction. Each agency's progress will be monitored through periodic reports made to Oregon's Department of Energy, or ODE. Any agency that fails to achieve the 20% reduction by mid-year 2015 will be required to submit biennial energy conservation plans to ODE until compliance is met. Second, in order to hasten the process of selecting private sector vendors who will assist our state agencies in implementing their energy conservation plans and to also ensure high-quality workmanship and performance standards, the bill directs ODE to pre-qualify contractors in the performance of energy audits, energy management service and control systems, capital improvements, operations and maintenance procedures, building commissioning, and energy savings performance contracts, or ESPCs. ESPCs are an important funding provision contained in House Bill 2876A. Under these contracts, as defined in ORS Chapter 279, the entire cost of each state agency's contract must be covered by the cost of the energy saved. Finally, the bill authorizes ODE to recover program administration costs from the agencies involved in the program. ODE plans to charge an assessment rate of $95 per hour for services and support provided to the state agencies under the bill. Colleagues, this bill will save substantial quantities of energy and money, provide more energy-efficient buildings for our state agencies, and employ a significant number of workers in bringing these efficiencies about. For these reasons, I urge your aye vote on House Bill 2876A. Thank you, Madam Speaker.
Further discussion? Representative Witt, do you wish to close?
No, thank you.
He doesn't. Just a moment. Excuse me, Representative Witt. Representative Richardson?
Thank you, Madam Speaker. Question for the carrier?
Question of the carrier. Does the carrier yield?
Yes, he does.
I'm disturbed or uncomfortable about this idea of pre-qualifying, and so I'm hoping that you'll be able to answer this question. In Section 8, it says the State Department of Energy shall pre-qualify prospective bidders or proposers to submit bids and so forth. What will be the criteria used by the department in determining whether or not a bidder meets the qualifications that, you know, that are determined? I mean, do they make their own qualifications, or is there some kind of standard?
A good representative from Southern Oregon. Those qualifications will be determined by the Department of Energy, and I would presume that that would be developed in rule.
To the bill.
To the bill.
Colleagues, I'm a little concerned about the fact that what we're doing here, while it sounds good on the surface, can have severe unintended consequences in that we're saying we're going to
require that there be a 20% reduction of energy on all remodeling and renovation and those kinds of things, and yet what does that cost? What does it mean to reduce that by 20%? How much would that cost on an older building that's being renovated, and will the renovation then not be focused on the purpose of the renovation but become focused on saving the energy? And while it's vitally important that we save energy, so often what we do have unintended consequences, and I'm concerned that by us taking this action, we may find ourselves years in the future having the plans, the architecture, the funding be focused on this bill and not on other important needs that need to be considered when there's going to be renovations of old buildings that were not designed to be concerned about energy conservation. 20% is a high number. I certainly would think that on all new construction that would be appropriate because it can be built into the design, but to require it on buildings that are going to be renovated, I think will have unintended consequences that we can't foresee at this time. Thank you.
Further discussion? Representative Dingfelder.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. Colleagues, to the bill.
To the bill.
Colleagues, I rise in support of this bill. We did hear this bill in my committee, the House Energy and Environment Committee, and I want to commend the carrier and the chief sponsor of this bill for bringing this forward. Colleagues, one of the least expensive sources of new energy is energy efficiency and conservation. What this bill says is that the state is going to lead by example, and we're going to show other entities, nonprofits, businesses, and other states that we can actually reduce our energy costs, save money in the long run, because we all know that energy costs are going up, not going down, and this is an excellent opportunity for us as a state to lead by example in reducing our energy costs. We also, the costs that we're looking at are in the short term, and we often see with energy conservation, as we heard yesterday in discussion on the solar bill, that there is a payback period, so we need to look over several bienniums for those cost savings, but this will, in the long term, eventually reduce the energy costs for the state. Thank you.
Further discussion? Representative Witt, do you wish to close?
No, thank you, Madam Speaker.
Those who are of the opinion that the bill should pass will vote aye, and those opposed, no. The clerk will open the voting system. Representative Morgan, how do you vote? Representative Morgan? Representative Morgan, how do you vote? Votes aye. Representative Jensen votes aye. Representative Wisnant, how do you vote? Votes no. Representative Flores, how do you vote? Votes no. All members have voted. House Bill 2876A, having received the constitutional majority, is declared. So House Bill 2876A, having received the constitutional majority, is declared passed. Members, could you please remember to check in with the desk when you have returned after an absence from the floor, so we'll know you're here. And the clerk will read the next bill.
House Bill 2895, relating to notification to law enforcement officials by health care providers.
The question now arises upon third reading and final passage of House Bill 2895A. Representative Barker.
Madam Speaker, to the bill. Colleagues, House Bill 2895A comes to you from the Judiciary Committee, where it passed unanimously. It requires health care providers to more quickly provide notice to law enforcement officials if a patient was a driver involved in a motor vehicle accident and has a blood alcohol content in excess of the legal limit. Currently, a health care provider has 120 hours to notify law enforcement that a patient in this circumstance has a blood alcohol content over the legal limit. House Bill 2895 changes this to require that notice be given to any law enforcement officer at the health care facility in an official capacity and is investigating the incident. If there is no such officer, the facility must notify a law enforcement agency in the county in which the accident occurred or an OSP dispatch center as soon as possible, but no more than 72 hours after becoming aware of the blood test results. Originally, we sought a 24-hour notification timeline, but the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems felt that would be very difficult for their smaller and rural hospitals to conform to, and a 72-hour was more achievable standard. This bill was worked extensively and is a real good compromise bill. It has no fiscal impact and deserves your aye vote. Thank you.
Further discussion? Representative Barker, do you wish to close? He does not. Those who are of the opinion that the bill should pass will vote aye, and those opposed, no. The clerk will open the voting system. Representative Flores, how do you vote? Votes aye. Representative Greg Smith, how do you vote? Votes aye. Representative Gilman, how do you vote? Votes aye. And Representative Jensen, how do you vote? Votes aye. House Bill 2895A, having received the constitutional majority, is declared passed. The clerk will read the next bill.
House Bill 2971, relating to methods of taking wildlife.
The question now arises upon third reading and final passage of House Bill 2971A. Representative Boquist.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. House Bill 2971A comes from your House Committee on Agricultural and Natural Resources. It allows the Department of Fish and Wildlife to appoint a person to act as an agent for the purpose of using one or more dogs to hunt or pursue black bear or cougar in compliance and execution of the bear management plan and cougar management plan adopted by the Wildlife Commission. What came before the committee for a point of reference is in ORS 498-164, the authority of the commission and the department to do this already exists. However, the good lawyers of the Department of Justice could not define agent, so therefore the authority does not exist. And this bill corrects that authority. Good bill should pass. Thank you.
Further discussion? Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. To the bill.
To the bill.
Colleagues, I rise in opposition to House Bill 2971 for two reasons. First of all, it's a special interest bill. Second of all, it's unnecessary. I'd like to speak to both points. House Bill 2971 puts the desires of a few above the desires, clearly stated desires, of the many. Voters decided to prohibit the use of bait and hounds when hunting bears and cougars with the passage of Measure 18 in 1994. In 1996, voters once again voted to prohibit these practices by rejecting a repeal of Measure 18. My district overwhelmingly supports Measure 18 to this day. In my view, this bill is an attempt to go around Measure 18. This bill violates the intent of Measure 18 to protect bears and cougars from unfair pursuits that use bait and hounds. Now, voters deemed these tactics to be unethical when used for sport, but allowed their continued use for protection from imminent danger and damage. And that's a very important point. Nothing in our law today says that hounds cannot be used to take out a cougar that is causing damage or is a threat. What this bill does, colleagues, is once again, it gives the sportsmen who were angry at the passage of Measure 18 a way to get around that law. That's what this bill is all about, in my view. House Bill 2971 basically implements the Cougar Management Plan, which allows for indiscriminate killing of animals that are not a threat to humans or livestock. And there's no evidence that these practices will reduce human-cougar conflicts. One of the ranchers who testified against this bill wasn't from my district, but I have many ranchers from my district, including from my town of Jacksonville, my district, who opposed this bill. One of the best pieces of testimony was from a rancher that was saying the indiscriminate killing of cougars, what we're doing is we're taking out the mature male cougars, which are the ones that actually are the ones that know enough not to go near humans and property, and we're leaving, in her words, the drunken teenagers to run loose. And it's indiscriminate killing of cougars. It just does not make sense. This bill allows for more cougars to be killed in an indiscriminate manner. It gives broad authority to the state to deputize any person to assist in the hunt. And this will essentially allow sport hunters to circumvent the ban on bait and hound hunting that was put in place by the voters. Those of you who were here last session know there was efforts continuously throughout last session to let sportsmen get back to hound hunting of cougars. And that's where this bill is heading. I'd like to point out, colleagues, that the rate of kill of cougars has doubled since the passage of Measure 18. It's not a problem of not being able to kill cougars. It's a problem of people not being able to use hounds in order to do it for their sport. The department now takes in, the Department of Fish and Wildlife takes in over $370,000 now from cougar tag sales to hunters. So you can go out, you can hunt cougar, you just can't hunt with dogs. And hunters throughout the state are killing cougars at an unprecedented rate. So the idea that we need to do this now to let the department deputize sportsmen to use hounds is absolutely unreasonable. The argument came up that if we didn't do this, then the department would have to pay expert hunters to go out after cougars, and why not let volunteers do it? Well, if we're going to do the Cougar Management Plan, we should do it professionally. Again, we've already have an abundance of cougar kills in our state. It's absolutely unnecessary. By that line of logic, our state police problem could be solved by volunteers. Heck, I've got a car. If I get a gun, then I can just be a volunteer on I-5. It doesn't make sense, colleagues. It's important enough for the state to do. It's important enough for the state to pay for, and the resources are there to pay for this program through the sale of tags to hunters. Again, this bill is unnecessary, and it is a special interest bill. I would encourage a no vote on this bill. Thank you, Madam Speaker.
Further discussion, Representative Gerard.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. As always, I'll be brief. First of all, I've told you about my district a little bit and that we have a real shortage of police officers. In my district, we also have a huge abundance of big cats, and I do mean big cats. On my road, there's six houses. Out of that six houses, in the last year, we've lost six cats, little cats, to cougars. And the problem is that Fish and Wildlife they don't have a big dog population to go out and trim the cougar population. We have just a tremendous abundance of cougars. That population has really just exploded. And it is, believe it or not, a real safety issue in my district. And it's easy for somebody from a different district in a big city that doesn't have a cougar, but when when you go out at night or you go out during the day, you have to be aware that that's a possibility in my district. And so my wife and I both kind of trained ourselves as to what to do if there is a cougar attack, and it is a very viable problem in my district, and I would appreciate those people to cross over and just allow some of these cougars to be taken by this bill, and to be and the use of dogs is paramount in doing that. Thank you.
Further discussion, Representative Esquivel.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. To the bill?
To the bill.
Colleagues, I guess a cougar problem is only if you don't have one. In the city of Medford, a couple of years ago, we had an individual that was delivering papers at 3 o'clock in the morning next to a grade school, and there was a dog walking up the street, what they thought was a dog. It was a young male cougar in the city limits of Medford. I've noticed since we've taken this hound ban and we banned the use of hounds, in the John Day Wilderness, when I used to hunt elk up there, we would see between 200 and 300 animals a year. Today, you're lucky to see 50 in a complete season. That's not just a myth. Folks, that's a fact. The Game Commission estimates the cougar population in excess of 6,000 now. It used to maintain itself pretty level at 1,000. This skyrocketing type of population only invites cougars to infringe upon municipalities and populated areas, because the young cougars must go away from their parents and establish their own territory. So they end up in municipalities and populated areas. I think this is a good bill. I would hope you would support it. And I'm just telling you what I have observed, but more importantly, what the cause and effect in my city is. Thank you.
Further discussion, Representative Roblin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To the bill.
To the bill.
I have to agree with the last speaker in the sense that where you live makes a difference. And in Southern Oregon, the population of cougars has increased, and there really are very few tools. It was noted earlier that we have a lot of tags sold for cougar hunting. In fact, almost every hunter that is out hunting is encouraged to purchase one just in case they were to come across a cougar. And the price has gone down to $10. But the real issue on this bill is about whether or not we have the tools necessary to implement the cougar management plan that the state Fish and Wildlife Department has developed. And that's where people get uptight. Right now, it's true, we can hire dogs from people and then have our ODF people take those dogs and go hunt. Prior to, just after the initiative was passed, we were able to do exactly what this bill is doing. This is a management tool that allows for our fish and wildlife to meet the requirements of the cougar management plan, which we have not been able to do since dogs were eliminated as one of the tools necessary to meet that plan. As was stated, 6,000 estimated cougars. The total population of cougars, given the amount of territory that each one takes for this state, is about 7,000 to 8,000 estimated. If we get to that level, every square inch of the state would have its own basic cougar who would need that amount of territory to habitate. We're getting close to those numbers as it is, and that's why we see more and more encroachment, especially in areas where cougar populations are high. What this bill does is it gives one more tool to our professionals to manage the cougar and the plan that exists today. I urge your eye support.
Further discussion? Representative Krieger.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. I'll give you a perspective as someone who spent the better part of 30 years out there managing wildlife as a state police officer, enforcing laws, trying to make sure that we sustain populations of predators that are just as important as the deer and the elk are. You probably, many of you, have seen the cougars that are on my door where it says, "Here, kitty, kitty." Two of the biggest ones ever taken in Oregon are there, and in excess of 200 pounds. And these animals can have effect not only on wildlife but on human safety. On our tree farm today, we have approximately 5% of the deer we had when we made cougar a protected animal and we could no longer hunt them with dogs. We've lost 95% of our deer. In fact, for the last 2 years, we no longer hunt deer on our tree farm because we want to try to do what we can to maintain what little we have left. It's not infrequent to go 2 and 3 months and never see a deer on a 400-acre piece of property that used to be very, very abundant. And this conversation has only talked about cougar. We need to be talking about bear, because bear population in Curry County is one of the highest in the entire world. We have received about $400,000 of damage from bear predation on our tree farm, and it's in the millions and millions and millions of dollars statewide annually. And that affects money that goes to school through taxes, but because these trees aren't going to be available for harvest. All of us in Curry County have to pay for our own predator control. I just sent a check in for $350 this year to help make sure we have someone out there to try to control those populations. My grandchildren, which I have 17 of, are no longer allowed to go out on our property without an adult or a weapon. And there's just a couple of them getting old enough they can take a gun out there with them. A constituent of mine had a large 75-pound German police dog. A cougar in Curry County went under the house, grabbed the animal, took it out, and jumped over a 5-foot fence with the police dog in its mouth. These are big, dangerous animals that can affect your private animals. There is no real effective way of taking a bear or a cougar as far as percentage of take of success of hunters without dogs. It doesn't happen. It never has. It's always been with a dog. That's the only way you really get to any significant percent of success rates when you're out hunting these animals in the field. And as a good representative from Coos Bay said, we need to have this as one of the management tools in the toolbox to make sure we can control those numbers. They need to be managed right now. They're not managed, and they're out of control, and it's not in the best interest of our wildlife resources. Thank you.
Further discussion, Representative Burley.
Well, thank you, Madam Speaker, for the bill.
To the bill.
Colleagues, if we could vote to overturn Measure 18, I'd probably vote for that. You know, as the representative from Medford pointed out, same issue with me. When I go elk hunting, I see more cougar tracks than I see elk tracks these days. I buy my cougar tag not to hunt them, but just to be able to have a legal harvest when I come across them when I'm out in the woods. I've had them track me. They're in the city of Bend. We're not expanding into their habitat. They're expanding into ours. The male juveniles are forced out. They have to go establish their own territory. 2005, some of you that were here will recall, I made the same comments in committee when we addressed this issue. They were tracking a cougar on the West Hills on Aubrey Butte and Bend, which if you're familiar with that, it's right where the community college is located. And when they were tracking that cougar, they found that it was actually sleeping under the deck of a house of a person that works with my wife. She has a 4-year-old kid. And it scared her to death to find out this cougar was camping, living, sleeping under her deck. We need to deal with this issue. We need to deal with it very decisively. And so I support this bill, and I'd urge you to support it as well. Thank you.
Further discussion, Representative Dallum.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. To the bill.
To the bill.
As I heard my colleagues go through the litany of problems created with unmanaged cougars, I think they've covered them all but one, game deprivation. In my district, which covers about 1/6 of Oregon, we have many communities that have seen cougars spray even madras in the backyard of our schools, and it is a huge concern. But the issue I want to bring to your attention is how we take a cougar. Having the dogs is, of course, important, but having the dogs without somebody that knows how to run the dogs, somebody that knows the dogs, and somebody knows what to do when the dogs react makes taking a cougar very difficult. A $10 tag gives you an opportunity if you see. Cougar control requires knowledge, and those people that Fish and Game will use have that knowledge. I urge your support of this bill. Thank you very much.
Further discussion? Representative Lim.
Thank you, Madam Speaker and members, colleagues. I rise in opposition of this bill that we are trying to find the answer in the number of cougars and black bears, but we need to find the answer in the human being. It is the human being control continually encroaching to the territory of these animals, which we love, which was created. And then I have my beautiful house in Gresham area. I used to have deer coming in my backyard. They slept over there night. Since the house built all over, I couldn't see them anymore. And so to me, current statute passed by the people already enough mechanism to control, and they're trying to give additional tools to get rid of some of the cougars. I don't believe it's a fair game. And it is not the Kugel's black bear's problem. I believe this is a problem of the human being. Thank you, Madam Speaker.
See no one further in the queue. Representative Buckley, you are recognized a second time.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. I'll be brief. Colleagues, just want to make clear, this bill is not about the Cougar Management Plan. Cougar Management Plan is in place. This bill is about how it's implemented. And the point I would like to emphasize is, if we are going to put the plan in place, it should be implemented. My colleague from District 59 made excellent points about how the people who should be charged with hunting cougars should be people who are trained to do so, people who know what they're doing, not simply opening the system up to sports hunters who simply want to use dogs for their own recreational benefit. This should be a very seriously accomplished plan to do a serious job for our state. Thank you, Madam Speaker.
Further discussion? Representative Boquist, do you wish to close?
Yes, ma'am. Colleagues, let me dispel some myths here, and rather than take on my fellow colleagues on the floor, let me talk about a couple of topics here, and then I'll close with quoting the law, not our rhetoric, not what we're all thinking about here, not ballot measure 18, but I'll give several quotes out of the law here. First off, let me talk about the cougar, bear, and wolf management plans. Individuals generally opposed to this particular bill are opposed to those plans because they don't do enough to preserve the wolf, the cougar, and the bear. If I had a vote on the Fish and Wildlife Commission, I would have opposed the cougar, the bear, and the wolf management plan too. In fact, I vocally did, as the former chair and the present chair of Ag and Natural Resources know, these are hot topics in my district. However, when you go and do a management plan, there is almost an entire year full of public hearings. Unlike Ag and Natural Resources, when we go to Baker City and get to sit for 6 hours and listen to both sides, you get to sit for 6 hours 12 times as a minimum when you go through one of these commission processes. And in the end, the commission, appointed by the governor, Governor Kulongoski, votes on a management plan and it's put in place. As I said, I'm not particularly fond of the Cougar Management Plan. I don't like the Wolf Management Plan at all. However, I'm pragmatic. It is now the adopted plan of the state of Oregon, and we need to provide the tools, again, the tools that they thought they had, as the commission appointed by the governor to implement this plan. Now, having said that, I'll quote from Oregon Revised Statutes, and this is the law, this isn't politics. I quote ORS 498-164, use of dogs or bait to hunt black bears or cougars, prohibitions, exemptions, and penalties. Subparagraph 2, nothing in subsection 1 of this section prohibits the use of bait or one or more dogs by employees or agents, I requote, or agents, of a county, state, or federal agency while acting in their official capacity. And remember, their official capacity is the execution of these plans. What transpired here is that the Department of Justice determined they didn't know what an agent was. So therefore, the commission adopted a plan, thought it had the tools, and the Department of Justice, boy, we've heard this lawyer joke before, folks. No disrespect to you lawyers. But the lawyers came in and said, oh, You got it wrong. What this bill does is go back and clarify that. And I quote out of A.N. Gross House Bill 2971, starting on line 10, as allowed by subsection 2 of this section, the State Department of Fish and Wildlife is authorized to appoint persons to act as agents for the department for the purpose of using one or more dogs to hunt or pursue black bear and cougars. Such hunt or pursuit must be in compliance with the Black Bear Management Plan and the Cougar Management Plan adopted by the State Fish and Wildlife Commission. Agents act on the department's behalf and, subject to the department's direction, control, implement specific management programs of the department. The agent may not engage in any other hunting or pursuit while acting on the department's behalf. End quote. Like many other bills, this bill is providing an agency with the tools to do its job. Whether I like the Cougar Management Plan, the Wolf Management Plan, or the Bear Management Plan, that issue's gone. Whether I support it or oppose ballot measure 18, that measure is gone. What we need to do is vote yes, pass this out to give the agency the tools it needs. Thank you, Madam Speaker.
Those who are of the opinion that the bill should pass will vote aye, and those opposed, no. The clerk will open the voting system. Representative Morgan, how do you vote? Votes aye. Representative Berger votes aye. And Representative Merkley was off the floor. Excuse for business of the House. House Bill 2971A, having received the constitutional majority, is declared passed. Representative McPherson, for what purpose do you rise?
Thank you, Madam Speaker. I ask permission to return to the order of courtesies.
Representative McPherson requests unanimous consent to temporarily return to the order of courtesies. Is there objection? Hearing none, please go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. It's my pleasure to welcome a large contingent from Mountain Park Church in my district. They are located in the seated in the gallery just above me, I trust. Although the sight lines from my desk this year are not very good to the near gallery here, but I hope you'll welcome them and extend the courtesies of the Capitol to them. Thank you very much.
Welcome to the Capitol. Further courtesies? Clerk will read the next bill.
House Bill 3092 relating to anatomical gifts.
The question now arises upon third reading and final passage of House Bill 3092A. Representative Kotek.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. Good morning, colleagues. House Bill 3092A comes to the floor today from the House Committee on Healthcare with a unanimous do-pass recommendation. It comes at the request of the National Conference of Commissioners on Uniform State Laws. The National Conference is an organization comprised of more than 300 lawyers, judges, and law professors appointed by the states to draft proposals for uniform and model laws where uniformity is desirable and practicable. Former State Representative Lane Shetterly is Oregon's representative to that body, and he presented this bill to our committee. House Bill 3092A would bring Oregon law regulating anatomical gifts into conformity with the Federal National Organ Transplant Act, the Revised Uniform Anatomical Gift Act of 2006, and Medicare regulations. This bill does a variety of things, most importantly, strengthening first-person consent by reinforcing an individual's decision to donate an organ and barring others from amending or revoking a gift made by the donor. Today, there are 2,000 individuals on the waiting list for organ and tissue donation in the Pacific Northwest, and more than 95,000 people nationally are waiting. In 2006, in Oregon, there were 103 organ donors and 347 transplanted organs. This bill is supported by Donate Life Northwest, the nonprofit home of Oregon's statewide donor registry, also supported by Oregon procurement organizations such as the Pacific Northwest Transplant Bank and the state's Medical Examiner's Office. I'd like to point out a small correction to the staff measure summary. This bill does not establish an organ donor registry in the Department of Human Services. Rather, the language in Section 17 reads, quote, the Department of Human Services may allow an organ procurement organization to establish a donor registry, unquote. So just to make sure it's clear, there's no fiscal impact or it's minimal impact issued for this bill because it's not a registry in the Department of Human Services. There were a couple amendments to the bill that was brought forth that we approved. They had the support of different organizations. We tried to align it with Oregon practice. And I urge your aye vote on this bill. Thank you.
Further discussion? Representative Kotek, do you wish to close?
No, I do not. Thank you.
She does not. Those who are of the opinion that the bill should pass will vote aye, and those opposed, no. The clerk will open the voting system. Representative Beyer votes aye. All members have voted. House Bill 3092A, having received the constitutional majority, is declared passed. Clerk will read the next bill.
House Bill 3178, relating to public charter schools.
The question now arises upon third reading and final passage of House Bill 3178A. Representative Roblin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is an important bill when it comes to charter schools. Having been involved in my community in the formation of two different charter schools, one of the things that is the most evident at the inception is that they have to have a place to hold their school. There's a lot of process that goes into making charter schools, including your local districts and the group that is forming to make a charter school. But one of the first questions they have to ask is, do we have a place to have this school? What this bill does, simply, is make it possible for a charter school proposal committee to ask local government entities to provide them a list of available facilities in their area that could be used. It does not require them to put every piece of property they have that's vacant. It just gives them the opportunity to give those things that are not being used for them to consider, and then to negotiate in good faith an agreement to lease or rent or buy those facilities for the charter school. We had a lot of debate. We eventually amended it to make sure that it was clear that that school districts and others understand they don't have to put a piece of property on the list because they may be having a discussion of selling it or doing something else with it in the future, but that if it is unused property, unused facilities at the time, make available that list so that the charter school has an opportunity to look at how we're going to get set up. I would urge your aye support. Thank you for your consideration.
Further discussion? Seeing none, Representative Roblin, do you wish to close?
No, thank you.
He does not. Those of the opinion that House Bill 3178 should pass will vote aye, and those opposed will say no. The clerk will open the voting system. Representative Barnhart, how do you vote? He votes no. Representative Clem, how do you... off the floor. Representative Kotek, how do you vote? She votes aye. Representative Nolan, how do you vote? She votes aye. House Bill 3178, having received a constitutional majority, is declared passed. Clerk will read the next bill.
House Bill 3313, relating to local government ability to recoup costs incurred for illegal drug manufacturing site rehabilitation and declaring an emergency.
The question now arises upon third reading and final passage of House Bill 3313A. Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, and you well recall that I'm carrying this one for the team. Colleagues, House Bill 3313A comes to you with the unanimous support of the House Judiciary Committee. This bill will provide local governments with a reliable method of recovering public funds that are expended to decontaminate and certify as fit for use those properties that have been used in the manufacturing of meth, also known as meth labs. It does this by establishing priority liens for local governments for funds that have been expended for this purpose. The owner of a property on which a meth lab site operated is ultimately responsible for having the property cleaned up by a state licensed decontamination contractor and for the cost of having the property certified as fit for use by the Department of Human Services. Not all properties that have been used in the manufacturing of meth receive the not fit for use designation. A decision to assign this status is made when an operation is shut down by a law enforcement agency, and factors include the size and the extent of the operation. It's important to note that this status is assigned to properties in the interest of public health and safety, as the chemicals and compounds used to manufacture meth permeate surfaces and substructures of buildings and can remain a risk to human health even after an operation has been shut down. Both DHS and local code enforcement agencies try to compel property owners to fulfill their obligation to decontaminate the properties by sending a series of notices and letters detailing their rights and responsibilities as property owners. The communications are sent to the owner and of record listed in the county assessor's office. In most cases, property owners voluntarily comply, and in the remaining cases, a contaminated property may simply be fenced off or a building boarded up, so those properties can sit unused and unattended but still contaminated for years. When this bill was first heard in committee, representatives from the Bankers Association expressed the concern of lending institutions about the establishment of a lien that would hold priority over a mortgage, trust deed, or any other secured liens, regardless of the time of filing. I'm pleased to report to you that these concerns were addressed and are satisfied in the engrossed version of the bill that is now before you for consideration. It does this by providing notice to any mortgage, trust deed, or lien holder that has a secured interest in property about a local government's intent to initiate decontamination activities. The parties are then provided with a window of opportunity to communicate to the government entity their intent to handle the decontamination of the property. There is a reference to nuisance properties in the staff measure summary, and that is described in ORS 105.555 as any place that has been determined to be not fit for use and that has not been decontaminated and certified as fit for use. There's also a discussion about toxic contamination from illegal drug manufacturing activities. These priority liens would not be available for common nuisances or code violations such as overgrown vegetation on a lot. Colleagues, this is a good bill. It will provide local governments with additional leverage to compel property owners to decontaminate the former drug labs. It provides notice to mortgage lenders about a serious problem on a property in which they have a secured interest and makes them a partner in the effort to decontaminate the properties. If compliance efforts fail, and if no interested party comes forward to take this action, it provides local governments with the assurance that they will be able to recover public funds expended to decontaminate the properties and certify them as fit for use. I urge your aye vote on House Bill 3313A.
Further discussion? Representative Flores, do you wish to close?
No, thank you, Madam Speaker.
She does not. Those who are of the opinion that the bill should pass will vote aye, and those opposed, no. The clerk will open the voting system. Representative Riley, how do you vote? Representative Riley? Off the floor. Representative Minnis, how do you vote? Votes aye. Representative Kremel, how do you vote? Votes aye. All members have voted. House Bill 3313A, having received the constitutional majority, is declared passed. Clerk will read the next bill.
House Bill 3436, relating population forecasting for land use planning.
The question now arises upon third reading and final passage of House Bill 3436A. Representative Boquist.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. Colleagues, House Bill 3436A comes from your House Committee on Agricultural and Natural Resources. And it is not an agricultural and natural resource bill. It has nothing to do with agricultural and natural resources. It has to do with population forecasting in cities for the development of comprehensive plans. If you're unaware, there's a sheet of paper on your desk that lists all the reasons you should vote yes for this bill. The principal reason is half the counties don't have a population forecast, so therefore, theoretically, half the cities don't have a population forecast to develop their comprehensive master plan. This simple bill puts in place a procedure that allows the city, in coordination with other cities, and advice to the county, to do a population forecast. It's a good bill. It should pass, and for the good colleague representative from Ashland, cougars are not part of this population forecast. Thank you.
Further discussion? Representative Boquist, do you wish to close? He does not. Those who are of the opinion that the bill should pass will vote aye, and those opposed, no. The clerk will open the voting system. Representative Barker, how do you vote? Representative Barker, off the floor. Representative Olson, how do you vote? Votes aye. Representative Riley, off the floor. All members have voted. House Bill 3436A, having received the constitutional majority, is declared passed. Clerk will read the next bill.
House Bill 3437, relating to exotic animals and declaring an emergency.
The question now arises upon third reading and final passage of House Bill 3437A. Representative Roblin.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. Madam Speaker, I move House Bill 3437 be referred to the Committee on Elections, Ethics, and Rules.
Representative Roblin moves that House Bill 3437 be referred to the Committee on Elections, Ethics, and Rules. To your motion.
Thank you. This bill, as we got it moved, had a couple small changes that need to be made. We had considered doing that in the Senate. The amendments are ready and clear. I think it will be a much better bill to send it to them corrected. So my goal is to send it to Rules, work on it very quickly, and get it back out here in a vote very soon.
Further discussion on the motion? Representative Roblin, do you wish to close?
No, thank you.
Those who are of the opinion that House Bill 3437 should be referred to the Committee on Elections, Ethics, and Rules will say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion, having received the required majority, is declared adopted. House Bill 3437 is referred to the Committee on Elections, Ethics, and Rules. Clerk will read the next bill.
House Bill 3485, relating to affordable housing covenants.
The question now arises upon third reading and final passage of House Bill 3485A. Representative Dingfelder.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. I apologize. That went very quickly.
House Bill 3485 comes to you with the unanimous support from the House Consumer Protection Committee. This bill authorizes the creation of voluntary affordable housing covenants that ensure an adequate supply of homes that are affordable for low and modest income Oregonians. As you know, no doubt already know, housing costs have placed home ownership out of reach for many hardworking families. From 2000 to 2005, the price to purchase a home in Oregon skyrocketed 62%. However, during the same period, Oregon was one of only eight states that saw a decline in median income. The stark contrast between the buying power of Oregonians' wages and the cost of a decent home highlights the need for a permanent and sufficient stock of affordable homes. Thankfully, we have several organizations and government agencies that are creating and preserving affordable housing to meet the needs of Oregonians across the state. These groups are investing precious private and public resources to build a growing supply of affordable homes. These same groups want to ensure that an affordable home remains one long into the future. Affordable housing groups often use a voluntary affordability covenant to achieve this purpose. The covenant typically requires that the buyer at closing be of low or modest income, and should the buyer sell in the future, that all subsequent buyers are low or modest income as well. However, even though affordability covenants are commonly used by many nonprofit organizations across the state, there is currently no single enabling statute. That means that should the affordability covenants be challenged in court, they might be at risk. Many people are concerned that the funds and resources already invested in affordable homes could be lost due to this legal uncertainty. And colleagues, by enacting House Bill 3485, we will amend Oregon statutes to clearly state that affordability covenants are valid and enforceable. It's important to remember exactly what House Bill 3485 does and does not do. It ensures that affordable housing remains affordable housing. It ensures that those Oregonians who need affordable housing are the only ones who get the homes in which we have invested scarce affordable housing dollars. House Bill 3485 does not mandate anything from property owners, nor does it affect conditions on property unrelated to affordable housing. It merely creates legal, enforceable land restrictions that are similar to others already contained in Oregon law, such as conservation easements and environmental covenants. House Bill 3485 will benefit the individuals and foundations that make donations to affordable housing providers, the local government agencies that encourage affordable housing development, the nonprofit organizations that maintain affordable housing units, and the thousands of Oregonians who need affordable housing. Today we have the opportunity to assist those among us who are tirelessly working to place home ownership back in the hands of everyday hardworking Oregonians. House Bill 3485 helps low and modest income Oregon families attain a measure of stability through home ownership, and I urge your aye vote.
Further discussion? Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. To the bill.
To the bill.
Colleagues, I rise in support of House Bill 3485 and just want to reiterate that these are voluntary covenants, and the importance of them is to encourage the private foundations and local governments to put their money into affordable housing. Without the assurance that the property will stay affordable, there may not be as much of an incentive, and we know how important affordable housing is in our communities, and accordingly, I encourage your aye vote.
Further discussion? Representative Garrard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To the bill.
To the bill.
Colleagues, last Friday we spent about 2.5 hours debating House Bill 3540, which would have been a very good motivator in helping to build new affordable housing in the state of Oregon. However, the majority of this body felt it well to vote that bill forward and against construction of affordable housing on the only land we have in Oregon. I find this bill somewhat contradictive. You shouldn't be able to have it both ways. On Friday, you vote to kill affordable housing, and today you want to bring it back. Thank you, Madam.
Further discussion? Representative Dingfelder, do you wish to close? She does not. Those who are of the opinion that the bill should pass will vote aye, and those opposed, no. The clerk will open the voting system. Representative Burley, how do you vote? Votes no. Representative Thatcher, how do you vote? Votes aye. Representative Flores, how do you vote? Votes aye. Representative Dallum, votes no. House Bill 3485A, having received the constitutional majority, is declared passed. Representative Flores, you are in the privilege queue. For what purpose do you rise?
Thank you, Madam Speaker. I request the return to courtesies.
Representative Flores requests unanimous consent to return temporarily to the order of courtesies. Is there objection? Hearing none, please go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. Colleagues, I would like to draw your attention to the back gallery where we have a group of students, fourth grade students from Damascus Christian School in my district in the second newest city in the state of Oregon, Damascus. And their group leader is Louise Walker. Hi, Louise, a longtime friend. And Carol Klingbeil, also a very longtime friend. So welcome, Damascus Christian.
Welcome to the Capitol. Enjoy your day. Further courtesies? Clerk will read the next bill.
House Bill 2175, relating to fitness of persons to provide care on behalf of the Department of Human Services.
The question now arises upon third reading and final passage of House Bill 2175A. Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. House Bill 2175A comes to you from your House Committee on Human Services and Women's Wellness. Currently, the Department of Human Services conducts approximately 17,000 criminal background checks each month, including checks for long-term care facilities, child care providers, foster care facilities, potential adoptive parents, and providers for individuals with mental health and developmental disability clients. This bill gives DHS authority to evaluate the fitness of DHS employees, providers, and volunteers in a variety of DHS-related programs and directs the department to work with providers to develop detailed rules to carry out a comprehensive screening program. In summary, it does two things. It extends the legal authority to DHS to use abuse and neglect reports for seniors and folks with developmental disabilities. Currently, DHS only has the authority to do that for children. Secondly, this is not a blank check. It actually asks that they develop a plan and bring it back to the 75th Legislative Assembly. Thank you, Madam Speaker.
Further discussion? Representative Gilliam, do you wish to close?
I do not, thank you.
He does not. Those who are of the opinion that the bill should pass will vote aye, and those opposed, no. The clerk will open the voting system. Representative Greenlick, how do you vote? Votes aye. Representative Kremel, how do you vote? Votes no. House Bill 2175A, having received the constitutional majority, is declared passed. Clerk will read the next bill.
House Bill 2382, relating to paternity.
The question now arises upon third reading and final passage of House Bill 2382A. Representative Krieger.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. Colleagues, House Bill 2382 was recommended by the Oregon Law Commission and passed unanimously out of the Judiciary Committee on April 13th. This bill meets with the approval of a large group of stakeholders who represent a broad range of interests. The work group consists of family law attorneys, representatives from the Department of Justice, the Oregon Judicial Department, the Department of Human Services, the Oregon District Attorneys Association, the Office of Public Defense Services, the Oregon Law Center, Legal Aid, and Dads of America. The primary purpose of this bill is to update Oregon's paternity laws, which, despite significant technological and social changes, has not been comprehensively reexamined for more than 30 years. This bill primarily deals with the establishment and disestablishment of paternity, which is foundational to family law, affecting custody rights, child support, adoption, inheritance, support enforcement, and juvenile dependency proceedings. This bill was carefully crafted to balance the interests of families, children, and victims of paternity fraud. Protects paternity fraud victims by removing outdated provisions of Oregon law that prohibited challenge to paternity. Under House Bill 2382, a person who proves paternity fraud and has a DNA test showing that he is not the biological father can disestablish paternity. The bill also protects children by allowing the court in limited circumstances to deny a claim to disestablish paternity when the disestablishment would cause substantial inequity. Finally, it protects families by providing clear and straightforward rules regarding paternity establishment for the courts to follow. Under Oregon law, there are three primary ways in which paternity is established: through a presumption of paternity, which generally applies when a child is born to a husband and wife; number two, when the parents sign a voluntary acknowledgement; and three, through a judgment establishing paternity. This bill addresses each of these methods to establish paternity and provides laws that are clear, consistent, and fair. Again, the changes in this bill respond to technology and societal changes that have been occurred over the last 30 years. Among the most important forces of change are the availability of genetic testing that can identify a child's parents with certainty, and the development of a sophisticated and complex federal-state program for establishing paternity and for collecting child support. In summary, this bill improves Oregon law by updating outdated family laws and enjoys approval of all stakeholders and comes to the floor with unanimous due pass from recommendation from the judiciary. Thank you.
Further discussion? Representative Krieger, do you wish to close?
No, thank you.
He does not. Those who are of the opinion that the bill should pass will vote aye, and those opposed, no. The clerk will open the voting system. Representative Beyer votes aye. House Bill 2382A, having received the constitutional majority, is declared passed. Clerk will read the next bill.
House Bill 2659, related to regulation of construction contracting trade.
The question now arises upon third reading and final passage of House Bill 2659A. Representative Holvey.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. I move House Bill 2659 be referred to the committee, the Joint Committee on Ways and Means.
Representative Holvey moves that House Bill 2659A be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. To your motion.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. There was a fiscal we were not aware of on this bill. It is a part of a package from the Construction Contractors Claims Task Force, and this was one of the recommended bills, and it needs to be with the other two bills from that task force, which are already in Ways and Means. So I urge us to move this bill there. Thank you.
Further discussion on the motion? Seeing none, Representative Holvey, do you wish to close?
No, thank you.
He does not. Those who are of the opinion that House Bill 2659A should be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means will say aye. And those opposed, no. The motion to refer House Bill 2659A to the Committee on Ways and Means, having received the required majority, is declared passed. Clerk will read the next bill.
House Bill 2765, relating to police officer training.
The question now arises upon third reading and final passage of House Bill 2765A. Representative Lim.
Thanks, Madam Speaker and members. This House Bill 2765A comes from the House Committee on Judiciary with a unanimous vote. And what the bill does is require Department of Public Safety Standards and Training, which is a DPSST, to require at least 24 hours of training in mental illness recognition using crisis intervention training model. The subject became dear to my heart as I followed the story of James Chessie last October. KATU News reported that Mr. Chessie died of a trauma to his chest. It later came out that Mr. Chessie suffered from schizophrenia. I do not want to put blames on any law enforcement officers. I just want to prevent losing more lives, which is good for mentally ill community and good for public image and also police officers. CIT model have been successful since 1988. They originated in Memphis Police Department when Memphis looked for a way to prepare their police with how to handle special responses in crisis. In 1998, Memphis Police Department joined in a partnership with Memphis Chapter of Alliance of Mental Illness, Mental Health Providers, University of Memphis, and also University of Tennessee. Since implementing this training, Tennessee, Texas, and Ohio have all benefited from CIT model. According to the Memphis Police Department website, the city of Memphis has experienced immediate crisis response, a decrease in the use of force, and arrest and officers injury during crisis have declined. In Akron, Ohio, more than 3,000 individuals have been processed by CIT officers since May 2000, with about 75% of cases being transported for mental health treatment and 6% arrested. This is a good bill. This will save lives of police officers and also citizens. And with this training, they can detect and defuse the crisis. Thank you very much, Madam Speaker.
Further discussion? Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, to the bill.
To the bill.
Colleagues, I'm just going to share with you really quickly here, and won't belinger this very long, but I'm in favor of this bill. It makes sense to me to have additional training for law enforcement out there in the field today to deal with folks that are struggling with mental health issues. I can think of numerous incidents over the past years and everything that I remember troopers in my offices around the state having contact with folks that were struggling with mental illnesses and didn't have a clue that that was the case. But let me give you a more recent example, and you'll remember this one. Earlier this year, there was an elderly lady from the Portland area that was trying to find her way to Wilsonville. She found her way to Newburgh, was stopped by an officer there, was issued a citation for reckless driving, was given direction to Wilsonville. About an hour and a half later, she is stopped in Estacada by a police officer there, issued a citation for reckless driving. She's still trying to find her way to Wilsonville. Through this additional training, hopefully officers will be paying more attention to that. Now, I can tell you from experience that folks that suffer from dementia as well as from Alzheimer's do tend to respond to one in authority. And that in itself is a mechanism to help train officers to recognize that. So this additional training right here, I think, will truly benefit families as well as law enforcement. Thank you.
Further discussion, Representative Boone.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. I rise in support of this bill, too, and as we've just heard from the representatives from Gresham and Albany, this is just a step in the right direction for our public safety officers to help them understand some of the issues that people that they are dealing with on a daily basis are and how to handle with them. It's very important. I'm also reminded of some of the cases we've read about in the paper, especially the young men in Beaverton, I believe, who was killed in the process of an incident, and it turned out that he had mental illness. It's just one more way to remind us that this is part of our physical health, it's part of who we are, and out on the steps, I believe right now, it is Mental Health Day today, and there's a rally. There's several people out there who would like to see you support this bill. Thank you.
Further discussion? Representative Kremel.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. To the bill.
To the bill.
Colleagues, I rise in support of House Bill 2765A. And to give you a little bit of an indication as to why I support this, I'm going to read you a letter that was sent to me by a constituent of mine. And she's also a good friend and has also, over the last 10 years, been my I know we're not supposed to talk about campaigns, Madam Speaker, but she's been my campaign treasurer. So we go back a long ways. We were on the City of Wilsonville Budget Committee together. My name is Rosemary Terry Barton, and I am testifying in support of House Bill 2765, which would require police to have training and recognition of mental illness in order to be certified. My nephew, James P. Chassie, Jr., was beaten to death by Portland police officers last September. He was mentally ill. Years ago, it was determined that mentally ill people should not be held in hospitals, but should be allowed to live in the community. James lived in an apartment not far from where he was killed. He chose to live in Northwest Portland because he had always loved that area, where he could hear live music, walk to his church, and just hang out in an area that was interesting to him. He was of slight build, weighing about 140 pounds. He was a very gentle person who would not even kill a bug. He did not bathe often or shave, so some people may have judged him by how he looked. The day he was killed, two police officers saw him standing on a street corner. He was undoubtedly scruffy looking, but he was not doing anything wrong. Later, the officers said they thought he might have urinated on the street, but they did not see him do that, nor did anyone else. They said they thought he might have been on drugs, but an autopsy found no drugs in his system. They reported that he was a homeless person, but he was not. It apparently did not occur to them that he might have been mentally ill. When they came at him, he ran. The officers and other witnesses said he had a look of terror on his face. Possibly he had been abused by police before and had reason to be terrified. Possibly his mental illness triggered the terror. We will never know why he ran. But the police chased him down, knocked him to the street, and beat him. Several other police officers became involved. Paramedics came and looked at him, but did not recognize his serious injuries. The goal of the police officers was to get him into jail for resisting arrest. He later died in the back of the police car. The officers involved have not been held accountable. How many other times have mentally ill people been mistreated by police in Oregon? Would this incident even have been reported in the paper if James had not died? Will these officers recognize mental illness when they encounter it again? The amount of training required by this proposed law is minimal, but it's a start. It's certainly better than nothing. I don't see how anyone could oppose this requirement, and it should be passed without delay. Colleagues, I really urge you to vote yes on this bill. Thank you.
Further discussion, Representative Minnis.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. I rise in support of this bill. I think police officers
need further training, and I think there's no objection to the bill. I do hope, however, when we pass the budget for this particular agency, they have received a substantial cut under the co-chair's budget, and that we need to restore that cut. With that, I need to also declare a conflict of interest, as I have a very personal interest in this agency, as I'm married to the director of the agency. Thank you.
Representative Minnis declares a potential conflict of interest. It shall be noted for the record. Further discussion, Representative Flores.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. Very briefly, I rise in support of this bill, colleagues, especially because those friends of mine who are very instrumental in the National Alliance on Mental Illness, Clackamas County, have been doing very good work coordinating crisis intervention training with the public safety officers in Clackamas County. It is a very successful model. In fact, a very good friend of mine from NAMI, Oregon, submitted a letter in support of this bill. I hope that you will all support it as well, not only with an affirmation, but a heck yeah. Thank you.
Further discussion, Representative Barker.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. To the bill.
To the bill.
I rise in support of this bill. I was trained through this model in Portland, in the Portland Police Bureau, and found it to be very useful. I would like to comment a bit, though, on the letter that was read. The person who wrote that letter was not present when that person was taken into custody, and I would dispute the allegation of that the police beat him to death. The person says he was a gentle person, and if you watch the news, you'll often see some horrendous crime and the neighbors and the family will say, oh, he was a nice, nice boy. He wouldn't harm a flea. They don't know him that well. And they also said he had possibly been abused by the police before. Well, he possibly might not have been abused by the police before. And the statement that the officers have not been held accountable, I would also challenge. There's quite a process they go through there. That was a tragic death, but you haven't worn the shoes of a cop, and you haven't run into 140-pound, this little slight guy. They can fight like a tiger, whether they're mentally ill, on drugs, or just wiry and ready to go. So it isn't like it's real easy to take somebody into custody like that. That was a tragic death up there. I'd like to see that never happen again. And so I ask your support so we can help train the police to do a better job in the future. Thank you.
Further discussion? Representative Lim, do you wish to close?
Yes. Yes, Madam Speaker. I just want to thank you to the chair of the House Committee on Judiciary, that the representative of Lake Oswego have such a wisdom to pass out this bill from the committee. I do appreciate that, and also the members. As already many of the legislators already mentioned, this is a good bill. This is a bill we needed. Currently, each city, each state, they have their own rule, try to do what's the best for the city, but this will mandate at least 24 hours of training, and it could be a classroom, it could be a field training. And in the future, now and in the future, as in the past, mental illness is a very important issue. People are growing more and more with the mental illness. We need to recognize that. Sometimes we don't have enough knowledge why they do that, but we need to find out the symptom, whether it is actually mental illness or not. With a proper training, at least 24 hours, police officers might be able to detect some of the issue and also diffuse the crisis instead of resorting to the forces. This is a good bill. I urge every one of our members support of this bill, sending strong message. Yeah, we care, the citizens of our state. Thank you very much.
Those who are of the opinion that the bill should pass will vote aye, and those opposed, no. The clerk will open the voting system. Representative Boquist, how do you vote? Off the floor. Representative Boquist, how do you vote? Off the floor. House Bill 2765A, having received the constitutional majority, is declared passed. Clerk will read the next bill.
House Bill 3176, related to motor vehicle telematics service providers.
The question now arises upon third reading and final passage of House Bill 3176A. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Colleagues, while I speak, I hope you'll watch the clock, because before I sit down, 16 more children will have been kidnapped here in this United States. There's been a 444% increase in abductions since 1982. House Bill 3176, amended, came out of the tragic death of a friend of my youngest son, Dalton Robertson. That's why we call it Dalton's Law. Dalton disappeared in a brand new car equipped with an anti-theft vehicle locator device. Because the device could only be activated by the vehicle's owner, law enforcement was unable to use it to find Dalton. When Dalton was found 5 days later, he was already dead. The coroner's report indicated his death occurred earlier that same day. Had law enforcement been able to quickly obtain the vehicle location, Dalton could have been saved. In a letter to us from Ann Robertson, the mother of Dalton, she explains there are numerous common sense reasons to support this bill, Dalton's Law. Most importantly, it will save time, energy, and the resources of law enforcement. It'll find missing persons, carjacking victims, or the lost and disoriented elderly. Use of Dalton's Law can lower the dangers of high-speed police chases, aid in search and rescue missions, and quickly solve Amber Alerts. But she says, the greatest gift of Dalton's Law is sparing a mother the frustration and anguish of knowing there is a way to immediately locate her son who's in imminent danger, but law enforcement is not being allowed to utilize it. Therefore, she had to wait in fear, wait and cry, wait and beg again for help, and wait until it was too late. House Bill 3176A engrossed was amended with the help from the Oregon Department of Justice, the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, and the Oregon State Police to ensure law enforcement has the tools it needs to rapidly respond while Oregonians have the civil liberty protections they deserve. On each desk, there's a copy of John Walsh's letter and Dalton's missing person poster. The first is to show that Oregon is leading the way. Once again, we get to be the first in the nation, leading the way in initiating this important new law. And people are watching. The second is to put a face to the bill to remind us that the bill is about saving lives, not police power. Only law enforcement can request information pursuant to probable cause or imminent danger. Only law enforcement can receive information, not an abusive spouse, a stalker, a non-custodial parent, etc. If police find a missing person who doesn't want to be found, for example, a battered wife escaping her husband, only the police will find that person. And when informed by that person of the circumstances, can refuse to provide information to the person who filed the missing person report. This bill cannot, and I'll say that again, this bill cannot be used by an abuser to find a victim. Current law does not allow an Amber Alert to trigger the release of vehicle information. The National Center for Missing and Exploited Children state that 3/4 of all child abductions involve the child being driven away in a vehicle, and the majority of abduction homicides. The child is usually killed within 3 hours of abduction. Therefore, time is critical, and this bill will drastically save time. There are already procedures in place, which have been working for years, for police to work with companies like LoJack in pursuit of stolen vehicles. These same procedures will carry over and ensure that telematics companies can work with law enforcement. There will be no need to reinvent the wheel in order to make the system work. The state of California is watching us. The California Assembly is looking to Oregon to pave the way with this legislation so we don't have another situation like Dalton's. Once enacted here, it can be copied everywhere, creating a national system to save lives. There is no mandate to install tracking devices in cars. Consumers are free to buy them or not. The bill simply allows appropriate emergency personnel to use existing technology to help find missing people. It is free, and we know already it works. LoJack has on their website the success story of a couple who were carjacked, gang raped, beaten, and left for dead by the side of the road. Only after they were able to dial 911 and report the crime could LoJack work with police. It's a success because information from LoJack recovered the vehicles and led to the arrest of 2 of the suspects. However, 3 of the 5 suspects are still at large and the crime still committed. If Dalton's law had been in effect, the police could have taken action as soon as witnesses reported the abduction, possibly leading to the successful arrest of all 5 suspects and possibly preventing the most heinous of their crimes from ever being completed. Besides the letter from John Walsh supporting this bill, we also have the support of AFSCME, the Department of Justice, the AG Office, Department of Justice, the Sheriffs, the SEIU, and the great Judiciary Committee who heard this and allowed us to move this bill out very quickly because it is so important. Colleagues, would you consider this? Out of 18 million college students, 234,000 commit suicide every year. That's 634 today. Besides every child being abducted every 40 seconds. Well, on behalf of the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, the President and CEO commends us for this bill. Since 1984, NCMEC has served as a congressionally mandated clearinghouse on issues involving missing and exploited children. They have worked with law enforcement on more than 130,000 missing child cases and have provided technical assistance and training to more than 225,000 law enforcement and critical and criminal juvenile justice professionals nationwide. The President says we know that immediate response is critical to safely recovering an abducted child. A recent study found that in 76% of the child abduction homicide cases, the child is killed within 3 hours after the abduction. Clearly, time is the enemy in these cases. In addition, their data shows that 70% of attempted child abductions involve a suspect driving a vehicle, and information about the location of a vehicle could prove vital to a child's recovery. Colleagues, in the first session, I sponsored a bill for a grandmother who had not seen her granddaughter in 6 years because the spouse of her daughter took the child from here to Canada, changed ID.
Representative Schaffler yields.
Thank you so much. Anyway, this child got to Canada with his dad illegally. Dad changed the name and went to Iran. Now, had this law been in effect between here and Canada, we could have stopped that. Grandmother died, never getting to see her granddaughter again. By enabling law enforcement to get vehicle tracking information without delay in cases of missing persons or where there is imminent danger to life, this legislation will significantly increase the number of abducted children who are safely recovered. And the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children say to you, we're grateful for your efforts on behalf of Oregon's children and ultimately all the children in the nation. We appreciated John Walsh from America's Most Wanted, who sent us this letter that you have on your desk that says you can make a difference. And the important aspect of this law is this is a tool already in existence. Those 8 little children are now 12 little children that have been kidnapped while I've been talking, more than likely could be found before danger or harm, other danger occurred or other harm. John Walsh says the American public has been instrumental in locating dangerous criminals like the 928 fugitives found to date by viewers of America's Most Wanted and finding missing children from Amber Alerts. While law enforcement will always need the public's assistance, our police officers and sheriff's deputies ought to have every available resource to fight crime and save lives. Dalton's Law will aid law enforcement and help save lives because the vehicle locating devices in use now can and should be used when law enforcement has an urgent need to do so. Dalton's Law also makes the best use of police and sheriff's time quickly finding missing persons and kidnapped children so their resources are available for other crimes and emergency. He says, I recognize that every minute counts when trying to find missing persons. I hope this whole assembly will join the Association of Sheriffs, the Association of State Police, police chiefs from cities, and these judicial groups I talked about earlier, and these employee associations I talked about earlier. I think this is probably one of the most important things we can do right now in Oregon. And to assure you, should you have any question about the U.S. Code and Title 18, this is legal. Please vote for Dalton's Law.
Further discussion? Representative Wisnant asks for a call of the House. He is joined by Representatives Minnis, Representative Scott, Representative Dallum, Representative Buckley, and Representative Garrard. The doorkeepers will bar the doors, the sergeant-at-arms will attend, and the clerk will call the roll.
Barker. Barnhart. Berger, Beyer, Bonamici, Boone, Boquist, Boquist Bruin, Buckley, Burley, Butler, Cameron, Cannon, Clem, Cowan, Dallum, Dingfelder, Chris Edwards, David Edwards, Esquivel, Flores, Galizio, Gerard, Gelzer, Gilliam, Gilman, Gerard, Greenlick, Hannah, Holvey, Hunt, Jensen, Conk, Kotek, Krieger, Krummel, Lim, McPherson, McPherson-Mauer, Minnis, Morgan, Nathanson, Nelson, Nolan, Olson, Reed, Richardson, Riley, Roblin, Rosenbaum, Schaffler, Scott, Shields, Greg Smith, Patty Smith, Thatcher, Tomei, Wisnet, Witt, Mr. Speaker, not answering, Boquist, excuse, not subject to the call, 2, Cowan, Crummel.
All members are present. Further discussion, Representative Barker.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. And thank you, Representative Wisnet, for gathering an audience for me here. I rise in support of Dalton's Law, and I want to thank the good representative from McMinnville for all her hard work and her son, Jay Gregory, for all his hard work. The case involved in California involved a young man being missing. The family got the tried to call LoJack to turn it on. They wouldn't do it, so the police, they got a hold of the police. The police said, turn that on. We have a helicopter up. We can find it. And they said, well, only the owner can turn it on, have us turn it on. And they said, but he's missing. And they said, well, when you find him, have him call us. And it ended up in a tragedy. And this is for police emergencies. You can get a court order if it's not exigent circumstances. But this will save lives. And it's not involved so that a spouse can call up and find out where you are at 2 in the morning. That's not what this is about. This is for true emergencies. The lady that Representative Olson talked about earlier that was mentally unstable and lost, she had LoJack in this law, and in fact they could have turned that on and found her and saved her life. And there were several others this year of elderly people who were confused and got out and ended up in the forest somewhere in their car stuck in the snow. And this will save lives. It's a great bill. And once again, thank you, Representative, for your hard work on that. Please vote aye.
Further discussion? Representative Nelson, do you wish to close?
I would just, Madam Speaker, I would just like to thank all of those who have supported us. And it gives me great comfort to know that all of our law enforcement divisions want this tool and will use it. And I appreciated their support, and I'll thank everybody for theirs.
Those who are of the opinion that the bill should pass will vote aye, and those opposed, no. The clerk will open the voting system. Representative Roblin, how do you vote?
Votes aye.
House Bill 3176A, having received the constitutional majority, is declared passed. Clerk will read the next bill. Yes, Representative Barnhart, for what purpose do you rise?
Madam Speaker, I move the House stand in recess until 4 p.m.
Representative Barnhart moves the House stand in... Representative, before I take your recess motion, we have some housekeeping that we have to do.
Thank you.
Before we take a recess motion, are there any announcements? Okay. Representative Barnhart, your motion. Representative Barnhart moves the House stand in recess until 4 p.m. this afternoon. Is there objection? House stands in recess.